بسم الله. I'm sure all of us have our worries, our problems, our preoccupations. I know I do. And as I have my conversations with various friends in this circle, I know that you do. And the things that we worry about are sometimes remarkably small in the big picture of things. And sometimes we have things happen or things come our way that really remind us of that. An hour ago I received an email that I want to share with you. There's a little background to this. This email is from a woman that we consider really a visionary and a saint. She has an important chapter in Camille's book, Women of Sufism. She lives in Damascus, Syria.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And strangely, just a few days ago, I pulled out an old video I had shot in Damascus 15 years ago and really looked at it or done anything with it. And it was of Nuha, this woman, and her sister Suha and some other people, including Maulana Asad Ali later in the video. So I was just remembering times that we had, beautiful times we had in Damascus, thinking of Nuha and Suha, these two beautiful sisters. Suha had been the translator at the American Embassy. Nuha teaches Arabic to foreign students. And so they were very much in my heart these last few days. And what do you know, if I didn't yet this morning get a LinkedIn message from Nuha? And I haven't been in touch with Nuha for 6 years. And so I immediately wrote back a little message, because all she said is, "How are you?" And I told her how we were. And here's her letter back. "Dear Kabir, Suha and I were very happy to hear from you, especially that you have nearly finished translating the books." These are some books of Asad Ali that we've been working on. "I think it is a good idea to put them together in one volume under this beautiful name. But you know, receiving a yes from Maulana is not an easy job to do, especially under the circumstances. Anyhow, I will try to pass the message as soon as possible." Well, Maulana Asad Ali, what she doesn't know is that he encouraged us to do this work, and in the end he said, "This book will be published in Louisville." It wasn't even our idea, but so I guess it's a yes. Then she says, "About me, I nearly finished the fourth book of the Prophet Muhammad's, peace be upon him, life history." I didn't know she was writing this. "And I am waiting for the time to publish them. And still I am with the Quran and Prophet Muhammad and his family. I can't tell you what an overwhelming joy it is to get connected to these excellencies with my entire existence." I know when Nuha says something like that, she means more than reading books. She's a person of extraordinary perception and capacities. Anyway, "How is the family? Any news about Camille? How are our friends that we met lately in Damascus?" That was 6 years ago, after Umrah, we went through Damascus and we visited. "Here in Damascus, we are doing fine. And although we feel that the world is against us, we are sure that the Lord of it is with us. He has actually never abandoned us. But it is the experience of Prophet Joseph, peace be upon him, with his brothers. He was dreaming of raising them to the stars, whereas they were planning to make him a wolf's meal. This is how we picture the situation here. Do you see how the Quran simplifies our lives? Please keep us in your prayers and greet the family and friends for us. With love from Damascus, Nuha. And I compare that to my own preoccupations of the day. Think of these people in Damascus and what they're facing. And their absolute trust that everything is as it should be, or at least that they are living in a state of intimacy with the divine that allows them to trust, to be patient, to be content, to be hopeful. Not hopeful about circumstances, not hopeful, will these circumstances be, will they get better or not, but the trust that their souls are as they should be. I don't mean that they are complacent about themselves and their souls, but that they know that if their soul is awake to their Lord, then there is nothing to worry about. When we spoke with Asad Ali some months ago and we asked him how he was, all he said was, we're living in the security of his security. And whatever he wants for us, we are content. So that's the news of the evening. Preparation for two upcoming retreats, one in England and one in near New York, in the coming 6 weeks or so. We've been working with the theme of practical Sufism. And I came to this theme after realizing at a retreat we did in Vancouver last month that maybe we've been getting ahead of ourselves. We've been having some themes that are maybe a bit nuanced, a bit subtle, a bit, I think, beautiful, but there is a need to go over the practical aspect of this spiritual journey. And sometimes we forget, having been on this journey for some time, you know, I sort of think, well, everybody knows this stuff already. Everybody's experienced things like we've experienced, and I don't necessarily talk about them. The practical side of the Sufi life, the Sufi way, the lessons we learn from our teachers, from our brothers and sisters on the path, that are very practical things. And without these things, without these beauties, I don't think mere books would have attracted us. You know, we've worked with themes in the last few years, like the soul as a work of art. Well, I find that meaningful. You know, the soul is what we have. And let's look at it as our major work, as a thing of beauty that can be creatively fashioned with the help of the divine, of course. Or we did a series of retreats on spiritual intelligence. You know, there's intellectual intelligence, then there were books on emotional intelligence. But what about spiritual intelligence? well, it was good to spend time on these kinds of themes. But I also sort of recognize the need in the case of some people to maybe go over some very practical, everyday aspects of the spiritual path. And I'm still working on it. And I was going to share with you, just sort of in outline form, some of the themes that we're working with. Maybe we'll talk about a few of them. And then in addition to that, I have a handout, some of the words of Shamsi Tabriz, Mevlana's teacher, that goes right to a much higher level. So I outline about six subjects of practical Sufism or practical spirituality, because it's not just Sufism, but we call it Sufism. Mm-hmm. What are we working with here? What is the process? And what's going on? What's in it for the human being? What is the human being? What are our capacities? And how are they to be developed? Because finally, this is what it comes down to. This has really been our interest. What is possible for each of us as human beings? How can we polish our own consciousness? How can we purify our own souls of distortion and confusion? How can we awaken those attributes in our humanness that are most characteristically human? So-called religion talks about a lot of other things. Maybe there are relationships here, but there's theology, there's metaphysics, there's the ecstatic, mystical poetry of Rumi, which we also spend a lot of time with, as you know. We've done it week after week. And somebody, maybe not everybody is immediately attracted to ecstatic, mystical poetry. It may just go over the heads of a lot of people. And say, what is this? What kind of human experience is this? And some of us know that kind of experience is at the heart of the human experience, but there is a kind of a build-up. There's a kind of journey before those experiences are possible and understandable and realizable and become integrated with life. Starting at the back of my list, I'll jump to the end of it. The last of these six themes is, how much are we open to the ecstatic nature of being? Well, actually, I consider that something really practical. You know, how much are we open to the ecstatic nature of being? And we don't mean being ecstatic because, you know, your equities have appreciated, or you found a beautiful girlfriend, or, you know, you've had a great meal. We're talking about the ecstatic nature of being itself. This is like both the ultimate human experience, and it's also very basic. This has got to do with everyday life. Imagine the human being who knows from the moment they wake up in the morning that we live in an ecstatic universe because it was created by the divine. It was created by an infinite creative power that is both truth and beauty and generosity and love. It created all of this. Did it create all of this to burden us, to bore us, to make life a wretched drudgery? Or did it create existence to reveal itself to us. So I kind of jumped ahead pretty far. Better get back to the practical. Okay, so from step six, and probably any day of the week I would have written these six or themes or so. They might be somewhat different, but not that different. Let's go back to theme number one. How we use our attention. How we use our attention. This is the fundamental human capacity. Do we exercise our attention? Or do we just sort of passively, you know, go along and let it be governed by whatever's out there governing us? And nowadays, what's governing us is a commercial reality, and with entertainment, with can I call it disinformation? Might I even say mind control in some sense? This is the public reality that takes our attention. So how can we use our attention to awaken to what's real? How can we give our attention to what we want to magnify? Because whatever we give our attention to, we magnify. You know how Rumi says it? Now we jump to poetry. The poetry is lovely, it's metaphoric, it's great, you know, literature. But Rumi says simply, if your thought is a rose, then you are the rose garden. If your thought is a thorn, or actually the word is like brambles, then you're just kindling for the bath stove. These beautiful metaphors, something very real, something very practical. Is your thought a rose? Is at any time today your thought a rose? Or passion flower? We were walking up to the corner and Kino said, oh, look, the passion flowers are blooming. She had on this purple dress that, was it this one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it looked like passion flowers, so I took a picture of her reaching for the passion flowers. Another metaphor. So, subject tonight is, and we're going over this really basic stuff because I know we have some guests tonight and you people who are newer here, or some are very new for the first time, actually a few, and a few others are relatively new. And in fact, everybody in Louisville is new as far as I'm concerned. We've only been here 9 months, a short time in this journey. So we're going over basics so that you don't think that Sufism is some kind of weird preoccupation of intoxicated poets, though some of us are. It's also the way of the most practical people. That's actually its beauty, I believe, of all the spiritual traditions that we know and have experienced. It is so integrated with life, grounded in life, practical. And most of us who are on this path probably would not have been attracted to it if we hadn't met it in embodied form, in human beings who absolutely melted our hearts and served us tea. So number two of the themes, how we interact with others. Doesn't seem like much. But when you consider, especially on the path of Rumi, in what's our tradition called the Mevlevi tradition, they say that the foremost spiritual practice is not days and days of meditation, though sometimes we may do that. It's not whirling, though we're famous for that. You know, It's not the poetry, it's not the zikr, not the chanting of God's names, though these are beautiful. It's not even the daily worship, the ritual prayer, though that's essential, the basis. The foremost practice of our tradition is manners, courtesy, but not as a formality. It's a courtesy to each other, it's a courtesy to our teachers, it's a courtesy to our prophets, it's a courtesy to reality itself, how we relate in respect, in humility, in consciousness. And this doesn't come without training and aspiration and good examples from people who have matured in some of these qualities. I would personally would have no idea. I'm an American. What do I know about manners? You know, that's not to say my parents didn't give me some, but not to the extent that I encountered them in the Sufi world. Not nearly that. Service, humility, respect, to where even a mevlevi would not, take a sip of this water without kissing the glass first. Or put on a cloak without honoring the garment. Or enter sacred space without stepping over the threshold consciously with the right foot. How we interact with others. So the Sufi or any truly spiritual person, and we're not claiming to be spiritual people or having attained that, but we aspire to it. We should be the kind of people whose egoism is diminishing every day rather than growing every day. At least moving in the right direction. Rather than increasing our self-importance, our pride, our arrogance. Theme number 3 sort of seems similar, but how hospitable, open-hearted, compassionate, inclusive, and non-judgmental we are. That's a mouthful. How hospitable, open-hearted, compassionate, inclusive, and non-judgmental we are. I put this in here because I know that I was on a spiritual path for a number of years. It was a very disciplined spiritual path. It had very little to do with being hospitable, open-hearted, compassionate, inclusive, or non-judgmental. What kind of spiritual path was that? I won't say what it was. There were things to learn. We learned a lot about consciousness. We learned a lot about will. We learned a lot about intention. But was the heart opened? No, not really. In fact, that path we were trying so hard to quote remember ourselves that the joke was, this is long after we left, and somebody said, don't bother me, I'm remembering myself. Four, how we care for the world around us, balancing the energies within our living space and the general environment. How we care for the world around us, balancing the energies within our living space and our general environment. In Sufism, and this is, could be a whole course, it's sort of like Sufi feng shui, if you will. You know, our feng shui begins with a prayer carpet and the direction of prayer. Wherever we are in the world, if we don't have a prayer carpet, we can find a towel. don't find a Tao, we can find a piece of paper. And establish that sacred space. A sacred space which is clean and which is sufficient to worship. And by worship, I mean to open up a relationship to reality. But along with that, we learn the nature of pattern. I mean, it goes far beyond that, of sacred proportion, of a certain kind of intentionality in the environment. One of our teachers once said, you know the difference between secular space and sacred space. Now, maybe instead of secular space, we could say profane space might be better, as we were speaking in another language. And I said, I know, I don't really know. He said, in sacred space, everything there is intentional. Whereas in postmodern profane space, you know, things are much more accidental, or they may even be what's the word I'm looking for? The postmodern sensibility is often one of where you don't take anything seriously. Everything is a comment on something else. Everything's kind of with a little wink, and we don't really take this seriously. And or it's governed by commercial messages. You know, how many people wear advertising as clothing, for instance? In a Sufi derga, if you bring a flower, you bring it in a vase that's perfect for that flower. I had one dear beloved student who raised beautiful flowers, and then she would show up and bring them in a mason jar with a salsa jar, you know, with the label still on it. And I just gently said, received the gift, thank you so much, received it, quietly called in somebody, would you put this in something else besides the salsa jar if we're going to have it here in this sacred space? These are little things, but we also have learned that pattern actually can produce health, and pattern can produce illness. Just as proportions can, this may sound like mumbo jumbo, but we've experienced this, we have worked with this. And we're, in this world, we're intending to maximize our possibilities to live in sacred space, to live, in other words, in under the conditions that maximize our possibilities. And we'll also accept the conditions that in which remembrance would almost seem impossible. We also have to be prepared for that. We have to strengthen the soul, the attention enough so that we remember God in the midst of New York City traffic, at times when you're late for catching a plane, at times when where the difference between life and death is this. Only as the soul develops only as the human soul develops do we live more and more on that fine edge and realize the preciousness of every moment, the critical nature of consciousness and being awake. I've seen my friends die because of heedlessness. I mean, to be dramatic. there are accidents, that's not what I mean. I mean a life governed by heedlessness over time, leading eventually down to greater and greater, shall we say, confusion, chaos, and finally death. It's possible. And we've also seen the other side of that, the miraculous, when we should have died. And something saved us. The reality we live in is not just an accidental material reality. We're not little mice caught up in a vast mechanical cotton gin of arbitrary gears and hammers and crushing mechanisms. We live in a reality that is animate, communicative, and if I may sound a bit, use some religious terminology, under the governance of God. And number 5, how we maintain a state of consciousness free of prejudice, negativity, and distortion. How we maintain a state of consciousness free of prejudice, negativity, and distortion. Now, most of us are not the kind of people who are likely to be involved with racial prejudice or cultural prejudice, or hopefully even religious prejudice. That's the crude self-righteousness that hopefully we are far, far beyond. But there subtle forms of distortion, subtle forms of arrogance, subtle forms of self-importance that we will literally spend a lifetime preparing ourselves to see. A lifetime polishing that mirror so that it reflects accurately and without distortion. There's actually a we human beings, even people who consider themselves more evolved and more consciously spiritual, we can get caught up in forms of elitism, forms of maybe feeling we have some special knowledge or the inside story on something, that our own particular channels of grace or association with holy people makes us something special. This is the subtle egoism of the spiritual path. And there's an actual Sufi saying that I think sums it up pretty well. For the man who loves kebabs, he would like to call them divine, if anyone would allow it. For the man who loves kebabs, he would like to call them divine, if anyone would allow it. So we spend a lifetime on this spiritual path, polishing, polishing, polishing. That's the meaning for us of la ilaha illallah. There is no God but God. But all the lesser deities of our own creation, of our imagination, of our egoism, all the idols the self invents, all the forms of specialness, of self-importance, of illusion, finally. As a matter of principle, we hopefully choose to move in the direction of humility, in the direction of selflessness. And by selflessness, we don't really mean that. It takes a little bit of explanation, because in Sufism, we're refining the self, we're not annihilating it. There's always some sense of self. what's the quality of the self? Is it so self-absorbed that it's unaware of other selves? Is it so self-important that it always needs to feel that it is right and its opinions are true? Is it the kind of self that is so governed by compulsions that inwardly we're in a kind of inner slavery to internal forces of either desire or negativity, of either lust or shame or guilt? All those are egoism. I mean, neurotic guilt is as damaging as arrogance, both equally illusory or necessary. But the human being who, as a matter of habit, as a matter of choice, as a matter of everyday practice, is just, we're just watching ourselves. We're just paying attention and going, well, there I go again, you know, doing that thing, forgetting the bigger picture. So there are a lot of beautiful teachings along these lines, but this is just a very quick survey of some themes that we hope to work with in the coming months. But not to leave us there on that elementary level, to give us a taste the way a real master views this process. I'm going to share with you, and you can take these home and get to know them better, a few quotes from Camille's recent book, which is an absolute treasure, called Rumi and His Friends. So these are, from Rumi and his friends, these are some of the teachings of Rumi's teacher that I found particularly rich. They're also practical Sufism. So, surrender, satisfaction, and remembrance. One day, Shamsuddin was discussing mysticism at Mevlana's madrasa. He said, God, may he be exalted, asks three things from all his creatures. First, submission. Second, fulfillment of proper behavior. Third, remembrance. Submission is worship. Proper behavior is being God's servant. And remembrance is knowledge of God. Remove your burden from someone else and carry his. Give up desiring something from others and give them what they desire. They are looking for riches. You must seek poverty. They desire honor and glory. And you desire humility. Someone asked, what is knowledge of God? Shams responded, the life of the heart through God may be exalted. That which is living, annihilate, and I refer to your body. And that which is dead, enliven, and this means your heart. That which is present, allow to be absent, and that means this world. That which is absent, cause to be present, and that is the world of the hereafter. That which exists, make non-existent, and that means the passions. And that which does not exist, bring into being, and that is intention. Well, maybe might as well just stop right here. So this is advice for people of a very high level. I would not, for instance, necessarily expect younger people, people who are developing their lives, their careers, getting an education, you know, maturing in their profession. I would caution you not to think that these words mean throw all that away. Don't throw away yourself before you have a self. Understand that what Shams is saying, well, requires the maturity of years as well as a mature teaching to support it. You could jump to some conclusions about what he really means by some of these things. So let me just say a few things about this last paragraph. That which is living, annihilate, and I refer to your body. You could make the mistake, and I think those of you who know Sufi teaching won't make this mistake, because you know the body is very much a part of our practice. Our practice is very embodied. We don't have a negative attitude towards the body. We don't see it as sinful. But there is a truth in this. Anybody who has fasted Ramadan knows that there is something about reducing our intake of food, reducing the amount of sleep we have. There's a way we can work with the body to help it become a better instrument for spiritual perception. And that burdening the body with too much food, too much sleep, with poor habits, we think we are satisfying the body. We're not. The body to us is like a beautiful horse to be trained. That which is living, annihilate, and I refer to your body. Well, we could really say aspects of the body that tyrannize us, aspects of the body that oppress us, or aspects of the body that veil us. So it's a very nuanced understanding of what our relationship to the body could be. It's also beautifully expressed when Rumi says, let your donkey carry your Jesus. Don't make your Jesus carry your donkey. You know, when the body's in control, when all we're doing, when the Jesus of our inner being is just trying to meet the needs of the body, and the body's saying, I want this, I want that, I want more of this, I want more of that, you're making your Jesus carry your donkey. You train your donkey to carry your Jesus. And that which is dead, enliven. And this means your heart. This is a huge subject. All of spiritual development is about awakening the heart, to be more sensitive, to be less numbed. But so much of life is numbing the heart, including food, by the way. You learn that when you fast. Your heart gets very sensitive. You have feelings that you've been repressing. You let them come up. You're purified by allowing them to come up and to consciousness. But to enliven the heart, when the heart is enlivened, it comes into living relationship with everything. The heart is the instrument of relationship. When the heart is numbed, people begin to look like things. When the heart is really awake, even things take on an animate quality. That which is present, allowed to be absent. And that means the world. speaking as someone who is curious about the state of the world, who seeks information and truth about the world. I also know that there's a fine balance as to how much time to give that, how much time and attention to permit myself. I usually, and I'm not saying I keep the balance well enough, but when all of our attention is going out into the world and out into matters of politics and rights and identity, yes, these are things that are important. But they're not as important as our relationship with our friend, our divine friend. And to cultivate that relationship, to be someone like our friend Saad Ali in Damascus. I don't know what he's doing these days, but the times when we have known him, he would spend at least, and he could, he'd spend a lot of his time in that solitary, silent stillness, face to face with the divine. For him, there was nothing, there was no greater pleasure than that. He paid some attention to the world. A letter from him could release thousands of prisoners, literally. But most of his time, especially as he matured, a lot of his time was given to that inner relationship. Now, granted, many of us may not be ready for that now, may not desire it, but because we have other relationships, we have family, we have children, we have responsibilities, we have jobs. And that's all fine, that's appropriate for us at this stage. But the key here is, are all of these things dominating us, or are they within this larger context of the divine presence? Really, you see your work as service within the divine presence, or does it become something that engulfs you, is bigger than you, and tyrannizes you? Those are two very different states, two very different relationships. To be in the world, to attend to the world, but to know that you're living in love's universe, or to be a oppressed self with the whole world stacked up against you and everything worrying, is it going to go right today or not, and how is it all going to turn out, and rather than living in God's space on God's white earth. Heard that phrase, God's white earth, it's in the Quran, very beautiful. And the Quran says, it's not God's earth wide enough for you. This spiritual path is, it is not about being burdened, it is about freeing ourselves from the tyranny that we create ourselves, for ourselves, by too much concern with the world. So Shams is saying, that which is present, allow to be absent. At least for part of your day, allow it to be absent. But some of us know, we try and sit, meditate, do zikr, and that world is just kind of seeping in from every direction. Some of you know that. How you create the sacred space within yourself that is free of all that, at least for a while. Then you get energized, you get a little illumined by that inner light, and then you go and you face the world and you do what you have to do. That which exists make non-existent, and that means the passions. Passions being those desires that are out of proportion. It doesn't mean kill every desire. certain amount of desire is necessary and good and beautiful, and we're not going to improve ourselves by mercilessly attacking every desire that the self puts forward. It's a waste of time. It's an impossible battle. But look to those passions, those desires that are out of proportion or inappropriate to your life. And finally, in that which does not exist, bring into being, and that is intention. And this is also, I mean, probably sometimes I think this is the most important word in the spiritual life, because without some intention, we're hopeless. We may forget our intention. We may not be able to sustain it 24/7. But if we know it's there somewhere, if we have an intention to remember the highest truth, highest truth we've ever experienced, or the greatest beauty we've ever known, or the purest state we've ever felt, we have that intention somewhere in ourselves, and return to it periodically and learn to do certain acts more intentionally and learn to complete cycles that we intend, then we will bring into being that which did not exist. So one commentary on one little paragraph of Shams of Tabriz, who for us represents just an example of a very high, very pure teaching. It was Shams who transformed Rumi. It was Shams who made Rumi what Rumi is. Rumi was not Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi until Shams came and put him through the fire. And put him through the fire of love, melted his ego, allowed him to let go of prestige, good name, and every idea he had of himself, to become the person we know today as this great voice for universal love, and most of all, a person who reminds us of the great generosity and beauty of the divine. That's his passion. That was his passion. Just, he wanted everyone to know what he experienced. He wanted everyone to know the awesome and beautiful generosity and intelligence of the divine, so that we could better awaken to the ecstasy of being, the ecstasy of what actually is, rather than to be oppressed by the kind of habitual thoughts, complaints, resentments, fears that seem to dominate much of human life, if we're honest. But thank God most of us can't really see how much we're dominated by those things, because God is merciful and it's only revealed to us step by step. It's also part of the spiritual journey. So usually on a Thursday night we have a bit more give and take, so forgive me. Tonight I did monologue a bit, but that was the feeling that I wanted to give something to our guests and complete something, to give a sense of wholeness as best I could in a relatively short period of time. But this is not the end of a conversation. Let it be an opening to any thoughts that you might have, or any questions, any things that these words might have awakened in you. Any needs that come to mind. Yes, my friend.
I'm not certain about the manner of the sima, how to participate, but I have...
You did exactly the right thing.
The way I believe our spirit, or a nafs, is begotten from the divine, and it is trusted to us to make it better and grow with it. And we have a lot of baggage in life. Growing up, for instance, if we laugh heartily, my grandmother would say, don't do that. Something bad will happen. Mm. The guilt. Yeah. You are not allowing your spirit to be unbridled.
Yes.
So my belief, different religion will teach you different things, will give you the same principle. You said a lot of things. I'm a Greek Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And you said so many things, I can repeat statements I learned through my theology. Will mirror what you have said. That's the beauty about our exchange.
Praise be to God.
Mm.
Absolutely. So the idea of evolution. I believe the more we evolve and develop our spirit, we may be able, not through the twirling dervish or singing or repeating things, where you kind of remove yourself out of this temporal world and try to be in the divine. I think we can see God, and we can live within the kingdom of God through knowledge, gnosis, which is forbidden by many religions. I'm talking about the organized way.
Right.
They are forbidding you from thinking.
Yes.
Tafkir leads to tafkir.
Yes.
And many of our brethren in the Middle East, you are not allowed to think outside of.
Mm.
And how can we do that? And we can help others to move forward. Because I truly believe we can live and see the divine while we're still on earth.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Well, this is what the mystics do, the mystics of all the traditions, the mystics that practice gnosis or seek it. And that tradition has been alive in the Eastern Orthodox Church. I know it has. Especially the wisdom of the heart is very much a part of the teaching. And it was kept alive there. There's always a danger, even, we have to acknowledge, even in the mystical traditions, too, sometimes they get a little bit, shall we say, I may use the word, polluted by man-made ideas rather than divine light. You know, often, no teaching is completely pure. We seek purity. And we try to discern, even in Sufism, what is the pure divine experience and what is cultural baggage, religious baggage. What is, I simply call these things man-made beliefs that are not really God-given gifts of perception. So I completely agree with you, Ramsey. And that's why in a Sufi circle like this, we have our tradition. We're part of a living tradition, and that tradition has a language. It has a framework. Metaphysically, that framework is not in conflict with, let's say, the basic metaphysical framework of Eastern Orthodoxy or the understanding of the human being, generally. And but here we're most concerned with the practical side. That's what I've been emphasizing. And we're not here. We're not, you know, I would get nervous if somebody walked in here and immediately wanted to say, can I convert to your religion? I would say, now wait a minute, you know. I would say it's some things to look at first.
I think the religion, whatever religion you grow up with, or you convert, or you believe, whatever the circumstances, it's a window. Through it you can see the universe.
Yes.
And if you look at it other than that, you are cheating yourself.
Perfect.
And your brethren and sisters. Because my way is not the only way. Your way is not the only way. Our way. If we are able to talk in harmony,
Yes.
I think we can see the truth and we can see the light.
Even I could quote Rumi. He says, the whole business of religion is to open a window in the heart. Yes. So how do we do that experientially? By silencing parts of the brain that are too busy and too loud, and by stilling some of the emotions to come to a state of being where we can begin to lift some of the veils and just look directly into our own, deep into our own being, where that window is. Window to the infinite. Thank you, Ramsey. In agreement. And then we also have practices that we do, for instance, when we chant together, when the various things we do together, that help to lift the vibration of all of us together. In a way that is harder to do ourselves. We benefit from the collective energy if that collective energy is attuned to something higher. That's how we understand worship, for instance, or the chanting that we do called zikr. Yeah. Natalie, right? Natalie's here for the first time. She recently graduated and did some Middle Eastern studies at Center College. Are we making any sense tonight with this crazy talk?
Very much.
Something led you in that direction. Something in your heart led you in the direction to study religion and look through that window. But this is a practical side of it. I mean, still we're mostly talking. The real work is when we leave here and live our lives and try to apply some of this knowledge. Human being is capable of extraordinary aspiration, and occasionally we're given glimpses. I speak from my own experience where we see, I can see, that my aspiration could be much greater than it is. You know, that while I'm not negative about the world or the human realm, certain moments glimpse the possibility that my heart could be more focused on something I don't even want to name or describe. But something I perceive when I empty my heart and awaken awareness and listen or watch. Same thing. Listen within, to look within with the eye of the heart. Just to be silent and quiet and to have a certain amount of time in each day to do that so that when I return to my responsibilities, I'm not completely lost in them. I'm not completely absorbed. I also think there's a great opportunity for creating a beautiful sense of brotherhood, sisterhood, community. That's also a practical side of the spiritual journey. I mean, there are different spiritual archetypes. There's the hermit, there's the yogi, the ascetic, the pilgrim, And then in Sufism, the archetype is more that of the lover. Lover of God above all. But the lovers of God also develop a certain sweet affection for other lovers of God. And some years ago when we had one of our annual retreats at Garrison, New York, I actually put out a survey and I actually asked our certain section of our community, what has brought you here? What have you valued in this teaching? Those of you who have been in it for some years. And they had a number of choices they could list. Is it the poetry of Rumi? Is it the Quran? Is it Islam? Is it love? Is it presence? Is it meditation? Is it music? I listed a bunch of things. And by far, the strongest attractor was the love that people experienced just coming together. Yeah. Well, there is an initiation for those who, when someone feels that the way of Rumi is their primary spiritual commitment, then an initiation is appropriate. And then there's a regular practice, and there's a relationship with the teacher and the community. And it is not all laid out and not all spelled out in an absolutely systematic way. I mean, but the teacher should have some idea of what the needs of an individual person might be. And then there's a general program which, if followed, leads gradually to maturity, spiritual maturity. But it's more like an art than a science, I would say. It's not exactly like medical school, for instance, where you could just take people through it and, have these different specializations and have your exam. And that's a different kind of knowledge and information. We could do that, but that wouldn't really be it. Yes, we could test people on how well do you know Rumi's poetry or how well do you know Quran. I know you didn't mean that. But, there are identifiable stages, yes. And how quickly one passes through them and how one gets through them, and if one gets through them, in a way it's partly between the soul and God. But having a commitment to a path is a big help.
Because there's some esoteric sects in Syria, for instance, where I grew up. Mm. I was born in Damascus. Mm. You mentioned Damascus, my heart started to cry. Mm. Those esoteric groups, the Alawite or the Alevi in Turkey, the Druze, you have to enter and get your knowledge, and you evolve with the knowledge. And I'm not talking about it from a religious standpoint, like I want to be changing my religion, my behavior.
Right.
No, I'm talking about knowledge, gnosis.
Yes.
And that's where you evolve and you can learn more and you reach the highest level. Hopefully, you will be able to see and live the kingdom of heaven while you're still alive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you, when you die, you are not afraid because you already know where you're going.
You got it. That's it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course. Yes. Different ways. Some ways are more systematic, and they even have dream systems where they expect you to have particular dreams to identify that you've reached a certain stage. And we know enough, shall we say, of comparative mysticism to know that even these dream systems are somewhat, shall we say, special to different lineages. And they work within that lineage. Within Rumi's teaching, we have experienced a number of lineages and their methodologies. that Rumi's teaching is so focused on love, the love of God, that it dispenses with a lot of those technologies. And we believe, and because we trust, it's not that we couldn't use those, or it's not that we don't know about them and have experienced them, but we trust that the quickest route to transformation is through the increasing capacity to love. So we give opportunities for service and relationship and things like this. And and it's not to say that this way is superior, what works for the individual and what their destiny brings them to is where they should be. But divine love is the great transformer. It's also the way of Jesus. And one of our practices is just this, just what we're doing now. Hopefully it's not words from the head, but from the heart, and words that have a relationship to the state I'm speaking from and about. And it's a sharing of minds, or better yet, the sharing of subconscious mind through the heart, where questions are answered without the speaker even knowing that such questions are answered. And where we put our minds and hearts together, and there is a unity of mind that lifts us all up a little bit. Because we're calling, you know, we're calling to the infinite, and the infinite loves to be called, loves to be invited into our presence. And, we just need to open to that. That's why our sitting and silence is very important. Sometimes I feel we could do just that. But there's a need for some knowledge, so we go over certain ideas that are transformative. These ideas themselves begin to shape how we perceive reality and how we understand what we ourselves are, what our relationship is to the Divine Presence. Even, you know, Ramsey mentioned that it's just a wind that our spiritual teaching can be a window to look through. That window, we also need to develop certain capacities within ourselves that are beyond our intellectual capacities, beyond our thinking mind that just accumulates information. The ability to give a steady stream of attention toward the spiritual dimension, and then to receive from that dimension. This is the purpose of life, really. Nothing less. Everything else is kind of a joke, really. And if the human heart can get accustomed to that, can develop that capacity to just sit face to face with the divine. It says of Muhammad in the Quran, when he made his ascension, he said, and his eye did not waver. A beautiful description. But most human beings, our minds are all over the place. We can hardly keep our attention, you know, especially in this society at this time. We have attention deficits. But we're learning. That's why I even played the Nay music. We began talking about breath. And I said, well, okay, let's be generous. Let's give the heart some beauty to focus on, knowing that actually we're focusing also on the breath of the nay player. We spoke about breath, we were aware of our own breath, and now here's a beautiful example of a master of breath who is transmitting not notes on a page, but he's bringing something from the unseen, something quite of that we call hall, right? That state. The Sufi music is the music of hall, the music of state, the music of a certain state of being. And just to hear that music takes you closer to that state. That's why music has been a big part of our tradition. And we laugh at the people who say it's not spiritual or not permitted. It's like saying breathing is not permitted or water is forbidden. The only people who would forbid what leads to spiritual health are those who are already spiritually ill and don't know what health is and mistake the signs of health for illness itself.
May I comment about the nine?
Yeah, please.
The nine is, I think, Rumi loved the nine.
He did.
Because it's the only instrument you are blowing from your soul.
Yes.
And it's going through my ear. There's a connection from your soul to my soul.
Right.
And there's no instrument like that.
No.
Other, you know, no. In the ancient world, that was really the instrument,
breath,
to get you connected.
Yeah. And he even takes that as a metaphor. He says, "You are the nigh. We are the flute pressed to the lips of God. And God is playing us. He's playing His melody through us." But they also say that nay, you know, before a nay can be played, you get the reed from the reed bed, but you have to put a red hot iron through it to, you know, hollow it out. That the nay is not going to make music if it's filled with mud, for instance. In fact, it needs a special curing, and it needs a special proportion. It has to be cut in a certain proportion. The holes need to be in the right place. Everything is about order and proportion so that the divine music can be played. Well, I hope we can take some of these aspirations and ideas, principles, and apply them. Make the most of these coming weeks when we won't see much of each other, some of us. And you're all invited back on Thursday, September 26th. We will be here again. One day with this group, I hope there'll be enough spiritual substance and willingness in this group that we will arrange for you to meet when we're not here too. That day is coming.